Thank you for tuning in to the Panopticast. Episode 1, Gaslight. Gaslighting is defined as when somebody is psychologically manipulated into questioning their own sanity. Now, despite the anachronistic-sounding name, the term is a little more contemporary than you might think. It originated when the British play by the same name opened in 1938, and was later performed under the name Angel Street in the United States. Born of humble beginnings, the contemporary definition of gaslighting has now been referenced in clinical psychological literature, political commentary, and philosophical texts since it was first coined. Perhaps the up-and-coming psychological colloquialisms of the 1950s necessitated a vocabulary term for the psychologically depraved act. Gaslighting was certainly around before its definition was solidified, and it became so widely adopted immediately after its definition was introduced because so many people were already familiar with the act itself. Gaslight was later adapted into two films, one in Britain and then a remake in the United States 4 years later. Gaslight also belongs to a unique subgenre of the melodrama, sometimes referred to as the Gothic woman's film and most commonly known as the Gothic melodrama. In literature, the Gothic melodrama was actually the first type of melodrama to emerge within the medium. But in film, the Gothic melodrama was a specialized offshoot of the ever-so-popular melodrama style that flourished during the 30s. Some key characteristics of the Gothic style include Gothic mansions, burning candles, foggy streets, gaslights, and mysteries galore, as well as a tragic or doomed romance that is certain to end in remorse, regret, resentment, or death. The subgenre is said to have really emerged in the late 30s and have carried through to 1961. However, while it is true that the Gothic melodrama was truly in its prime in the 40s, the earliest example I could find was actually directed by Roy William Neal and released in the UK in 1935, entitled The Black Room.
Authentic relic of the Black Room. One of the most horrible legends that has ever come out of the Dark Ages. Imagine a baron of an old castle. A baron who fascinates women with an almost hypnotic attraction. He loves them violently, and then he murders them.
The genre wouldn't see much production in the United States until 1940, with the critical smash hit of Hitchcock's Rebecca, which later went on to win Best Picture at the Oscars that year, as well as Best Cinematography and many other nominations.
Announcing the return of the most glamorous motion picture ever made, David O. Selznick and Alfred Hitchcock bring you the Grand Slam Prize winner that made motion picture history, winner of the Academy Award, voted by America's critics as the best picture of the year. And now, as a result of a national poll, winning new honors as audiences throughout the country vote to see it again. The Selznick Studios successor to Gone with the Wind, Rebecca, brought to the screen with all the warmth and emotion that made millions of readers acclaim Daphne du Maurier's bestseller as the most exciting love story of our time.
This is no surprise when considering the melodrama's reliable popularity, as well as the star power behind stars Laurence Olivier, Joan Fontaine, and the director himself, Alfred Hitchcock. At the time, these films made a killing domestically and internationally. According to Cine Weekly, a trade paper that catered to the British film industry for nearly a century, the two films with the highest grossing box office in 1945 were both Gothic melodramas, those being The Seventh Veil and Madonna and the Seven Moons, in that order. For a genre that is so outdated by today's standards that most people would be hard-pressed to name a film within the Gothic melodrama's parameters, there certainly is a lot of select films from the genre that are still considered classics by many film scholars, directors, and audience members alike. Perhaps the genre never gained much notoriety because, as Diana Sadoff talks about in her book, Victorian Vogue, British Novels on the Screen, films that were primarily marketed as Gothic typically didn't do very well in the box office. An example being the critically acclaimed yet underperforming screen adaptation of Jane Eyre in 1943.
It has always been true, but never more true than it is right now. The pictures you enjoy most are based on the most widely read novels. Recall Grapes of Wrath, Gone with the Wind, How green was my valley? This above all. Rebecca, great pictures, all of them. And now 20th Century Fox brings you Jane Eyre, based on the most widely read novel in our language, printed and reprinted 100 times, most recently by the Book of the Month Club. Its immortal lovers are played by the most discussed celebrity in the entertainment world, and the actress who won the Academy Award in Suspicion.
Whatever happens, do not open a door.
Now, you can't see it here, but the trailer features a superimposed quote from Photoplay magazine that refers to Jane Eyre as a thrilling, unforgettable mystery romance. Yet the scenes from the film that are used in the trailer all feature distinctly gothic elements, with architecture and set pieces that look like they belong in early modern era Europe. Compare that to the trailer for Rebecca, which uses similar verbiage when describing the genre elements of the film.
There is mystery, love, and laughter in Rebecca, the motion picture still unsurpassed for suspenseful romance.
Yet it showcases production design that is more familiar to an average American voyeur in the 1940s. That is high-class modern architecture, automobiles, and tuxedos. The most successful films in the genre were typically marketed to the public as a romantic drama. Some names including Wuthering Heights in 1939, Now Voyager in 1942, and Great Expectations in 1946. A large portion of these films were certified audience hits and are often still referred to as cinematic essentials by film critics. But similar to the genre's defining aesthetic, the gothic melodrama also houses some subtextual concepts that are both reflective of the socio-political consensus at the time on female health and the female role within society. I wanted to investigate the portrayal of emotionally distraught women in the gothic melodrama and some of the claims that the genre was symbolically critiquing the patriarchy. Psychological thrillers were some of the most popular films of this age, such examples including The Spiral Staircase, The Stranger, and The Third Man. This was the era where Hollywood blockbusters were appealing to the nationwide obsession with psychoanalysis and its integration into colloquial discourse. I hesitate to define the gothic melodrama's psychological characterization as a portrayal of mental illness, seeing as hysteria was a common medical diagnosis for women at the time. The name itself is derived from the Greek word hystera, which means uterus. This pseudo-mental affliction could be seen as a form of gaslighting on a massive scale, essentially the entire psychiatric industry claiming that women were subject to a gender-specific mental illness wherein all semblance of reason and logic is lost and a manic, emotionally deranged form takes over. The protagonist in The Seventh Veil attempts suicide at the start of the film because of her hysterical episode, which is then solved by her doctor's application of psychoanalytic treatment to allow her access within her own subconscious. The tagline on the poster reads, "It dares to strip bare a woman's mind." In The Woman in White, Eleanor Parker's character is pretty much hysteric from when we are first introduced to her. Gail Russell's character in The Uninvited nearly drops off the edge of a cliff from her mania after being sent to the sanitarium. With all these examples, the central question poses itself in relation not only to Gaslight, but to the genre as a whole. To what extent was the woman's film made in support of female liberation from the oppressive grip of the patriarchy? Were the male filmmakers presenting a symbolic resistance to the patriarchy or finding a less explicit means to embrace masochism on the big screen? This is a question I want to dive into in this paper, as someone who wants to make films in the future, but also as someone who would like to learn from past injustices as to not repeat the same mistakes made by any cinematic era whose glorification and nostalgia overshadows some of its more controversial aspects. While I will be primarily using Gaslight as a case study, I do want to investigate some of the panoptic themes that permeate the genre as a whole. Films such as Rebecca and Dragonwyck that feature a similar tone and share traits relating to the captivity of their female protagonists, but which might have different themes regarding female liberation. In my first section, I will examine the various ways in which the Gothic melodrama stigmatized female mental illness, what female mental illness suggests about the strain that the patriarchy places upon its victims, and how these films employ cinematic techniques to help the audience empathize with our female protagonists. However, we must be careful not to confuse empathy with solidarity to see how Gaslight and other Gothic melodramas deceptively suggest female liberation when they are, in fact, only suggesting a less explicitly abusive, openly misogynistic prison. What is perhaps most important to consider here is the fact that the woman's film was engineered for female audiences, hence the genre's nomenclature. Any appearance of solidarity with feminist ideologies may very well be because of the filmmaker's desire to subvert the panoptic oversight of the male gaze, but it is equally likely that there appears to be that kind of thesis for the sake of selling tickets to their target demographic. This is a difficult assertion to make without some sort of in-depth study, and for my analysis of the American version of Gaslight, my argument will determine whether or not the film poses a true escape for our protagonist, or if she is just leaving one patriarchal prison just to be subject to the bounds of another. Literature review. The late 1940s and early 50s had a strong sense of irony ingrained into the colloquial consumer culture. In a desperate attempt to make a global pro-capitalist statement, the U.S. supported a conformist consumer zeitgeist that evoked accusations of communism for anyone who didn't follow the capitalist status quo. Despite the mass influx of conformity, the late 40s and early 50s were still subject to a variety of critique from various scholars, some of the most prominent and polarizing being The Lonely Crowd, a 1950 sociological analysis by David Riesman, Nathan Glazer, and Ruel Denny, and Modern Woman, The Lost Sex, a 1947 examination of the sociological and psychological state of women in the post-World War II era. Although both sources have different subjects that they focus on to get across their point, both books provide extremely subjective critique, despite Modern Woman's listing as a work of scientific literature, on the compromised state of American society after World War II. The Lonely Crowd takes up more of an issue with the cultural evolution of society from a tradition-directed to inner-directed and finally other-directed society. Tradition is pretty self-explanatory. Social types obey the rules set by past inheritors of the civilization, and modern innovations to said rules are few and far between. Inner-directed was the successor to tradition, wherein people were not preoccupied by trying to fit and live in accordance with previously established norms, but rather looking within to act according to their own inner gyroscope. The main point of critique comes from the other-directed culture of the 1940s and 50s, a type of social dynamic that runs entirely based off the function of how other people live. Riesman identifies the Industrial Revolution and the development of the middle class as the point at which this kind of social dynamic took over. Although the main issue the book seems to take up is with consumer culture and the future of the younger generation being skilled consumers, the other-directed individual is also contingent on how others spend their time and what their views on politics are. This ideological conformity turned out to be a monumental force in popularizing the political messaging in Modern Woman, which has an opposite approach to determining the detriments facing American society. While The Lonely Crowd is specifically critical of consumerist propaganda plaguing U.S. culture, Modern Woman seeks out the root of contemporary American problems such as socialism and feminism. The former source argues that social conformity is the problem, while the latter pinpoints diverging opinions and life practices as the primary issue. As you might guess, Modern Woman places the blame for social malaise on the growing number of roles that women must fill, specifically how less time spent fulfilling a domestic role has thrown off beneficial social dynamics. With the loss of the self-contained traditional home, women's inner balance was disastrously upset, the book says. Upon publication, Modern Woman was an instant bestseller, partially because Lundberg and Farnham were able to discern the tremendous misery and discontent of modern times. My research will investigate this source as a means of understanding the consensus of how women and their mental health were perceived during the post-World War II era. especially when considering the book's far-reaching impact on popular culture, even inspiring Betty Friedan's intellectual retort 20 years later. Understanding the critique of this era of American history is crucial to determining the nature of the Gothic melodrama and its moral messaging concerning the role of women in modern society. Although the majority of these films seem to employ a decent amount of strategic ambiguity, starring a sympathetic, dynamic woman lead to reel in female audience, but not too liberal as to come off as feminist propaganda, there is still subtext to read into to determine the filmmaker's true intentions. In Home is Where the Heart Is, the feminist argument about the nature of the melodrama is put into perspective by a series of essays written by influential film theorists such as Thomas Elsesser and Mary Ann Doan. Doan argues that the woman's exercise of an active investigating gaze can only be simultaneous with her own victimization. This is certainly a very prevalent aspect in a lot of melodramas wherein the female lead is stripped of her agency at the whim of some emotionally abusive husband or significant other, and the audience is asked to empathize with her struggle. Although this is sometimes read into as a kind of symbolic sign of solidarity with feminism, the real moral messaging comes across during the resolution to the conflict. Some male third party, typically a love interest, comes into play and saves our female protagonist from her autocratic, psychotic husband. I would argue that, while I agree with Doan's statement in Home is Where the Heart Is, our protagonist is less so a victim as they are a prisoner. Although the filmmakers posit that the transformation from one lover to the next is the ultimate resolution to our protagonist's central conflict, I would argue that this is merely a continuation of the thematic struggle facing our lead. Take, for example, Gaslight, a film that concludes with our protagonist, Paula Ahlquist, played by Ingrid Bergman, uniting with Detective Brian Cameron, played by Joseph Cotten, after surviving the omniscient abuse of her former lover, Gregory Anton, portrayed, of course, by Charles Boyer. In that dynamic, we certainly see how Paula is being victimized by her husband. However, the film shows Paula making the conscious choice to be with Brian Cameron after the fact, essentially going from one lover who knows more about her past than she does right to another who is seemingly omniscient throughout the film up to this point, albeit in a much less deranged and toxic manner than Gregory was portrayed. Paula is essentially making the conscious effort to go directly from one prison to another, possibly because that's all she's ever known, or perhaps because the filmmakers are portraying that as the natural progression for audience members who are in toxic relationships of their own. Go find someone else who can control you, but, you know, in a non-abusive way. Part 1. Don't trust your husband. The concept of mass conformity in the 1950s was contradictory to the McCarthyistic utopia that many envisioned for the nation post-World War II, but the fear of the bomb, communist spies, and Sputnik all scared Americans and thus bred personal daily pressures to conform. This widespread incentive to conform as to not be seen as a dissenting voice among the nation's capitalistic values was, of course, exclusionary to those who weren't considered to be ingrained in the suburban consumer culture at the time. This trend primarily excluded racial minority groups and lower-class individuals, and while this conformist exclusivity didn't go entirely unnoticed by the media at the time, the rising trend of popular culture was in support of suburbanite, middle-class values that promoted a nuclear family structure and mass consumerism. There was simultaneously a tacit understanding that women were already an integral part of the American industrial complex, and the collective rallying force of those who thought women in the workforce spawned poor mothering and, as a result, was compromising America's future inheritors. These dueling narratives on female socio-political status were particularly embodied by the psychoanalytic anti-feminist contentions of Ferdinand Lundberg and Marina F. Farnham in their book Modern Woman, The Lost Sex. While the duo acknowledged that the woman's place had moved beyond the domestic sphere and had been since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, They posited female presence in the workplace as a breach of a social contract that upheld familial values. Instead, they argued that women straddled two conflicting identities of homemaker and employee, which was the root of the nation's social despondency. However, for Lundberg and Farnham, these implications were far greater than just general malaise, going so far as to claim the penis-envied feminists were suffering from a sexual disorder, and the greater the disordered sexuality in a given group of women, of course, meant the fewer children they have. In her 1963 retort, The Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan noted the extent to which this book impacted popular culture, noting how its thesis was spread across magazines such as Ladies Home Journal. Psychotherapy itself was weaponized against women who sought out refuge for their self-doubt surrounding their clashing identities through psychiatric help, and ultimately advocated for the role of domestic caretaker as the solution. This was all part of a growing trend of psychology working its way into daily American life, with psychoanalytic terminology being used in colloquial speech and being represented in nearly every form of media. This was perhaps most evident in Hollywood, and the inclusion of psychoanalysis into the romantic endings of many melodramas at the time. And while the majority, if not all of these films, were made through a male perspective as a kind of sexual sell to their feminine concept, in various ways, a lot of these films represent the symbolic battle of female socio-political advocates against the capitalistic patriarchy that refused to address gender-specific economic and social disadvantages. The POV, point of view shot, is most commonly cited as the cinematic culprit of inciting the male gaze, an example being Hitchcock's Vertigo, where we are asked to identify with John Ferguson as he obsessively pursues the woman of his romantic fantasies. The male gaze asks its viewers to objectify the female form through the act of voyeurism, and while it is far more prevalent in Hollywood films and other media throughout history than the alternative, some post-World War II gothic melodramas were able to subvert aspects of the phenomena. The Seventh Veil features a POV shot wherein our lead, Francesca Cunningham, portrayed by Anne Todd, is surrounded by a group of her psychiatrist peers who clutter her field of view with their collective gaze. As opposed to the female gaze, wherein the male form is sexualized through the eyes of the female, an example being Gary Cooper's body shot in the 1930 film Morocco, this subversion to the male gaze is meant to be an ugly reflection of the objectifying view itself, a perspective of the male gaze. It's implied that this kind of objectifying behavior is what caused Francesca's suicidal ideation in the first place, a subtle implication of the mental ramifications that the male gaze has on its victims. This could easily be interpreted as a feminist standpoint that the film is taking, yet once the psychoanalytic aspects come into play, the subtextual narrative quickly changes. With the help of Dr. Larson's therapy, Francesca is declared cured of her mental illness and comes to the realization that her true love is for Maxwell Leydon. The film connects the cure to female mental ailments with the introduction of true love into one's life. So, while the film implies the cause for the problem is male oppression, it also implies that the solution is male adulation. The Seventh Veil shared thematic aspects with the rising trend of what film critic Emmanuel Levy described as a "don't trust your husband" film. Other noteworthy gothic melodramas at the time with plots featuring female mental illness caused by their malicious male counterparts include Rebecca, where the second wife of a widower is terrorized by her emotionally unstable husband and his housekeeper, Jane Eyre, where a young woman marries a man only to discover that he is hiding a mentally ill and deranged wife from her, and Dragonwyck, where a farm girl marries her cousin who is revealed to be his previous wife's killer. We can see a trend threaded throughout each of these examples wherein a woman falls in love with a questionable man who then goes on to evoke some kind of mental distress before the end where love reigns supreme over all. In Jane Eyre, Rochester's mentally deranged wife commits suicide, an act which allows him to marry Jane. In Dragonwyck, after Nicholas is revealed to be a murderer and is shot to death, the film ends with a romantic relationship spawning between Dr. Turner and Miranda. In Rebecca, Mrs. De Winter's marriage is saved after her husband's homicide charges against his former wife Rebecca are revealed to be unfounded. However, as is the case with our study of gaslight, we can see how the house itself is transformed into a kind of labyrinthian entrapment. Similar to Paula in Gaslight, Mrs. De Winter is thrown into a deceptive situation with an unscrupulous male counterpart under the guise of an aristocratic marriage. Mrs. De Winter lives in the shadow of her widowed husband's first wife, Rebecca, and her transition into Rebecca's image is both actively imposed and criticized by Mrs. Danvers, the maid of the Manderley estate. This antagonizing female maid role is replicated in Gaslight as well, with the character of Nancy, who farther deceives Paula of Gregory's scheme against her own sanity. At one point, Danvers nearly convinces Mrs. De Winters that the only escape for Manderley is suicide.
You've nothing to stay for. You've nothing to live for, really, have you? Look down there. It's easy, isn't it? Why don't you? Why don't you?
And Nancy keeps a watchful eye on Paula as Gregory's bidding, further inducing the fabrication that Paula cannot maintain a level of sanity necessary to be free of oversight.
Nancy, did you turn the gas up in there?
Turn it up?
No, why? Well, I thought it went down in here as if you had.
I never touched it.
But this went down.
There is a tangible link between women's mental health and domestic space here, a motif that permeates both films, implying that a compromised home leads to hysteria-induced insanity in women. Each of these examples of gothic melodramas feature plots wherein there is some form of female advocacy against different forms of domestic abuse, even going so far as to imply that that abuse incited some form of mental illness in each of the female protagonists. The fact that each of these films ends with marriage or love to some degree undermine this advocacy and begs to question why this is such a prominent theme within the genre, as if the filmmakers were convinced that without a romantic ending, their film would flop in the box office. Likely, the filmmakers were trying to appeal to their primarily female audience with a happy conclusion to a tumultuous climax. But in doing so, the message changes from a symbolic resistance to patriarchal influences into male love being the savior of troubled women in toxic relationships. The patriarchy is the fundamental problem, yet it also acts as the solution. This is similar to psychoanalysis as a practice, where female autonomy is acknowledged, yet condemned. In reality, that condemnation was more directed at the dueling roles of women in society and how that distress led to penis envy and their mental ailments. The mere fact that they had economic independence was the cause of their distress and the ultimate degradation of the nation's future. The gothic melodrama seems to take a softer approach, yet in the same vein, nonetheless. While the woman's film acknowledges the injustices that the patriarchy has inflicted upon the female population, and seemingly implies those damages to be the root of their mental illness, it also concludes that heteronormative love for their male counterpart is the undisputed cure. When taking into consideration that all of the films mentioned in this section were written and directed by men, and that their intended audience was women, it begs to question whether or not the filmmakers were actually presenting a symbolic resistance to the patriarchy through their protagonists, or whether they were just trying to appeal to their demographic while subtly suggesting a romantic embrace of the patriarchy. Too often in the gothic melodrama is it that we see what our female protagonists must sacrifice in order to obtain true love, such as Francesca's musicianship in The Seventh Veil or Paula's singing career in Gaslight. These films imply that true love is not only the cure to our protagonist's mental afflictions, but also supersedes whatever personal passions or desires that our female leads formerly possess. The final remark of most gothic melodramas is that of a sudden, unexpected, or not so unexpected, depending on how you look at it, romance that acts as the perfect antithesis to the unhealthy relationship that our protagonist was formerly involved with. Take, for instance, Dr. Turner and Miranda in Dragonwyck. For starters, Dr. Turner isn't Miranda's cousin. And while the film makes the obvious acknowledgement that Miranda being involved in an incestuous, homicidal relationship is, in fact, detrimental to her well-being, it also shows Dr. Turner being the literal and emotional savior to Miranda's affliction with Nicholas. The same can be said about Paula and Brian's romance at the end of Gaslight, wherein the deceptive and murderous Gregory Anton, aka Sergius Bauer, is brought to justice by the detective work of Brian Cameron, who has been keeping a watchful eye on number 9 Thornton Square since the murder of Paula's aunt, Alice Ahlquist, as of years prior. Throughout the film, there is an eerie panoptic sensation that accompanies the film's request for us to empathize with Paula, as we, as an audience, are aware of both Brian and, to a lesser extent, Gregory's watchful eye over her. We are also led to believe that Paula is aware that she is being watched by some amorphous entity that is making footsteps in the attic and causing the gas lights to dim and brighten for no apparent reason. Although Gregory insists that this is only in Paula's imagination. This deception leading into Paula's insanity is the central conceit of the film, and what led to the definition of the term gaslighting. And the film is effective in its attempt to make Paula seem like a prisoner in her home and in her marriage to Gregory. However, while Gaslight implies that Brian Cameron is the solution to all of this, it also portrays his omniscience in a panoptic light. Essentially, by the end of the movie, it could be inferred that Paula is escaping one prison being run by Sergius Bauer, only to be captive in another, run by Brian Cameron. Or, even more likely, is the concept that Brian and Gregory's panopticons are one and the same. Part 2. Gaslighting the Prisoner. First, an overview of the panopticon. For our purposes, we will be examining the philosophical concept which stems from Jeremy Bentham's 1971 proposal for a prison system, which he calls the Penitentiary Inspection House. The infrastructure is described as follows. The building is circular. The apartments of the prisoners occupy the circumference, aka the cells. The apartment of the inspector occupies the center with the intention that none of the cells would be able to see inside to distinguish whether or not the inspector is actually within. The overall intention of the prison system is to minimize the amount of security necessary to manage prisoners, as well as to maximize the amount of time the prisoners believe they are being watched. In 1975, Michel Foucault took on this concept and expanded it into a philosophical statement about modern society in his book Discipline and Punish. The book begins by acknowledging the shift in punishment at the turn of the 19th century, from corporal to prison. But after noting the common form of all prisons wherein a few could supervise a large number, Foucault maps this transformation onto the bigger picture, stating that panopticism is merely the solution to a technical problem, but through it, a whole new type of society emerges. Our society, in a sense, is put into contrast with what German prison reformer M.H. Julius describes as the antiquated civilization of the spectacle, the age of public life. Modern society is not one of spectacle, but one of surveillance, as instead of having amphitheaters, stages, and grand displays of corporal punishment, we procure the ability for a single individual to oversee a great many. Instead of living in fear of a physical punishment, we live in fear of punishment of our souls, and thus we have learned to accept the panopticon into our lives and let it discipline us into fitting within a democratic capitalist society. Although the subjects and outcome relating to the entrapment of Paula and Gaslight are different from those depicted in Discipline and Punish, Paula's domesticity and relationship to Gregory is panoptic nonetheless. The scale is cut down to surveillance of one prisoner only, yet the dynamic is largely the same. Paula is perceived by both Gregory Anton and Brian Cameron when she is fully unaware of their presence, yet is acutely aware of being watched by something, The don't trust your husband melodrama differentiates itself from the typical male gaze seen in Hollywood films with a wider audience appeal,
as Marianne Doan
states in Home is Where the Heart Is. Because the woman's film obsessively centers and re-centers a female protagonist, placing her in a position of agency, it offers some resistance to the to-be-looked-at-ness of the woman, her objectification according to the measure of the masculine structure of the gaze. Its narrative structure produces an insistence upon situating the woman as an agent of gaze, as investigator in charge of the epistemological trajectory of the text, as the one for whom the secret beyond the door is really at stake. To appeal to a female audience, Gaslight situates what
Doan would call
an attempted construction of the female fantasy, wherein the bulk of the action takes place within the home, including most of the film's most climactic moments of suspense and horror. This alone is reason to believe that the film has a false advocacy for female liberation, as the filmmakers are indirectly perpetuating the notion that a woman's place is in the home by depicting a threat to the domestic life to garner a female audience. Not to mention the question of whether or not Paula truly has agency at any point within the film, given that her cogito ergo sum, or proof of existence, as Stanley Cavell calls it in Contesting Tears, wherein Paula is convinced that her memory is serving her right and that she is not, in fact, crazy, is inspired by the other centric male figure in the film, Brian Cameron. Yet the main determining factor about Gaslight's feminist advocacy lies in the fate of our protagonist, and whether or not she truly escapes the panopticon of the male gaze. Although we are asked to sympathize with Paula and the film offers a less sexualized retort to the male gaze by placing the audience in her shoes, ultimately, Paula is still subjected to a panoptic fate with Brian Cameron, albeit one that is less openly aggressive and misogynistic, yet just as equally oppressive. After the homicide of her aunt, a 14-year-old Paula Ahlquist is sent to Italy to follow in her aunt's footsteps and study opera singing. However, after she reaches full maturity, Paula relinquishes her dream in pursuit of her love for Gregory Anton, who insists that they get married after knowing each other for only 2 weeks. Paula decides to take a trip to Lake Como to clear her head and make an educated decision, but is shocked to find Gregory already there, waiting for her immediately after she gets off the train. This shot in particular is significant because it is arguably the beginning of Paula's panoptic relationship with Gregory. After her discussion with Mrs. Thwaites, Paula steps out of the train and is framed within the railroad's car window when her arm is suddenly accosted by an anonymous hand grabbing her from off-screen. The camera then swings over to reveal that Gregory has already arrived in Lake Como to meet her, making Paula, and the audience, acutely aware that she is being watched, even when she is unaware of it. And depending on your definition of marriage, one could argue that Paula is already a prisoner. Regardless, the power dynamic between Paula and Gregory is implicitly defined not only by Gregory's uninvited arrival and relentless insistence at a premature marriage, but also by the low-angle shots of him as he and Paula discuss moving back to Thornton Square. Paula seems eager to please Gregory, cinematically conveyed by her high-angle shots, and she is more than willing to put aside her own traumatic experience with Thornton No. 9 to satisfy his facetious fantasy. Once Paula and Gregory move back into the house in London, Paula is led to believe that she is going insane due to Gregory's insistence that she has been stealing random items around the house and not remembering doing so. When Paula reacts distressfully at the thought of not being in control of her own actions, Gregory claims that she is acting hysterical. This is most prominently seen during Paula's breakdown at the piano reception after Gregory accuses her of stealing his watch, a very important scene which we will eventually come back to. The diagnosis of hysteria itself is a form of gaslighting, overriding any authentic mental affliction such as anxiety or depression and declaring it as a pseudo-psychological disorder. Although Gaslight was made at a time where psychologists still deemed hysteria to be a completely legitimate diagnosis, one could interpret the film's request to empathize with the victim of gaslighting as an avant-garde retort to psychoanalysis. Paula's hysteria-driven insanity is even ironically reclaimed and weaponized by our protagonist at the end of the film, wherein she psychologically tortures Gregory with the concept of her own mental dysfunction while he is tied to a chair awaiting prosecution. A nice symbolic moment wherein the tables have turned and Paula has the agency over an entrapped Gregory. On the contrary, while the audience does get a nice sense of schadenfreude at the sight of Paula's mockery, that really only comes as a response to the past hour and a half of watching our protagonist being victimized by the panoptic torture of her omniscient husband. What is less up to interpretation, however, is how Gaslight paints an imbalanced portrait of power between Gregory and Paula. The more we find out about Gregory, the more it becomes evident that he has been watching Paula ever since her aunt's death when she was only 14 years old. And while Paula has been unaware that she was being specifically watched by Gregory, she nevertheless describes a kind of amorphous, anonymous presence keeping an omniscient eye over her since that night. She says, "I was in bed and something woke me. I've never known what." This motif of an amorphous observer is also present when Paula is being held captive in her home on account of her declining mental state, symbolized by the footsteps overheard and the fluctuating gaslights in her room. This, of course, is later revealed to be Gregory taking a back route from the alley into a vacant house next door so he can sneakily slip into the top floor of Thornton Number 9 via a skylight. Yet, the amorphous embodiment of this omniscient presence is symbolically significant, because Gregory is not the only one who has been watching over Paula ever since her aunt was murdered. Brian Cameron is framed to be the perfect antithesis to Gregory, caring, heroic, and American all alike. Yet they share a crucial commonality, that being the night of Alice Ahlquist's murder. For Gregory, it was the night that his search for the Ahlquist family jewels resulted in homicide, and for Brian, it was the all-too-personal case that was left unresolved. When Brian sees Paula and her resemblance to her aunt, it spurs him to reopen the cold case from years prior, yet she is left completely unaware that he is watching her or that he even knows who she is at all. In multiple scenes, Brian and Mrs. Thwaites are seen observing Thornton Number 9 from outside and taking meticulous note of Paula's antisocial behavior. Although Paula is completely unaware of Brian's gaze, she is also unaware of Gregory's. Rather, she is just aware that something is watching her. Brian even notes how she is just as beautiful as her deceased aunt, a point which the film posits is a more favorable kind of onlooking than that of Gregory's. But in both cases, these characters know more than Paula does and have been observing her since the incident. And in both cases, Paula has no way of knowing when she is being watched, nor who she is being watched by. This lack of knowledge on behalf of our female protagonist seems to be a recurring theme in other gothic melodramas such as Rebecca, wherein Mrs. De Winter is completely ignorant to the history of Maxim's past affair with his first wife or of the motivation of Mrs. Danvers. We must not forget that this is a staple of the gothic melodrama for suspense purposes. Since we are meant to identify with most of our main character, what she discovers is also what we discover as part of the dramatic arc of the film's plot. However, what makes these instances pertain specifically to the parameters of the Don't Trust Your Husband film is that the knowledge being withheld is used to question our protagonist's sanity and her devotion to her marriage and her household, essentially challenging our protagonist's ability to maintain their social function. Whether intentional or not, the challenge that these films present for our protagonist is reminiscent of the struggle women have faced on a national scale for decades, embodied most appropriately by the argument that women's declining mental health is a result of their fractured roles in society. Perhaps no scene exemplifies this duality better than that of the piano reception, wherein Brian sits behind Paula and Gregory to take note of any suspicious behavior. Gregory knows to look out for Brian, given their shared past intersecting at the death of Paula's aunt, and when he sees that Brian is attending the reception, he acts accordingly by convincing Paula that she took his watch to create an excuse to take her home to a more controlled environment. Paula is being watched here by both parties, yet is completely unaware of any forces beyond that of her own mental affliction. When Brian comes into Thornton Number 9 later in the movie, he admits to knowing a lot of things about this house. Brian even convinces Paula to trust him by giving her Alice Ahlquist's glove, one of the many details about the Ahlquist case that Brian claims to be privy to. After Gregory is brought to justice, Paula and Brian romantically finish off the film by reuniting atop Thornton Number 9's roof, and yet Paula has not truly escaped her panoptic entrapment. Conclusion. There are, of course, some notable exceptions to this trend within the genre. One could even argue that our male counterpart, Stefan, is actually the one who is entrapped within Lisa's panoptic oversight in Letter from an Unknown Woman. Since Stefan is the unknowing object of Lisa's desire, he is put into a similar position to that of Paula and Mrs. De Winters, albeit one without the domestic conflict. At the end of the film, Stefan is haunted by a teenage Lisa's apparition, even being watched over after her death. Now Voyager features our protagonist, Charlotte, essentially becoming the surrogate mother to Jerry's daughter. Charlotte's struggles also primarily exhibit in some form of an implied mental breakdown, resulting in her staying at a sanitarium twice within the film. However, beyond the prison-like social role that Charlotte is confined to, the film doesn't necessarily evoke a sense of her being entrapped in a panoptic relationship with anyone, except perhaps her mother, whose tyrannical neglect and untimely death drives Charlotte to the sanitarium both times within the film. I consider these films to be the exception to the pattern, but even so, they share some key characteristics with the previous films discussed. In Now Voyager, Charlotte's indirect adoption of Jerry's daughter reinforces the stereotype that the most fulfilling social role for women is child-rearing, and the film embraces psychoanalysis to a whole new extent with the sanitarium. The sanitarium that Charlotte checks into both prevents Charlotte from having a nervous breakdown and introduces her to Tina, Jerry's daughter. In this instance, the sanitarium takes on a similar role to that of the male savior. Although the roles are swapped in Letter from an Unknown Woman and our female protagonist is taking on the part of the proverbial inspector, Lisa's role is significantly compromised. As the film's name implies, Lisa's identity remains completely anonymous to her love, Stefan, and the only point at which he realizes how he was being perceived is also when he decides to duel the deceased Lisa's husband. Regardless of the specific parameters, the gothic melodrama certainly features reoccurring themes of deceit, inevitable romance, and less explicitly, how the confinement of our protagonists result in mental illness and even death in some cases. While this presents itself as a kind of solidarity alongside women's liberation, some of the most distinguishable and remembered films from the genre's era actually present an equally oppressive and omniscient alternative for their protagonists' predicaments. This is exhibited in the form of a male savior who is more knowledgeable about the circumstances our protagonist is thrust into, and thus more adept to solve it and to take proper care of our protagonist. Whether Paula is trapped by Gregory's abusive oversight or resigned to her relationship with the equally omniscient Brian Cameron, she is the sole prisoner within the Panopticon.
Writing songs of love, but not for me. A lucky stars above, but not for me. With love to leave.